This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Thank you once again for joining us on Trumpet Hour. I'm Joel Hilliker. How can you keep your head high in these crazy times? It truly is stunning to witness all the lunacy taking place in today's world, especially in the United States right now with race riots continuing, coronavirus and lockdowns still wreaking economic havoc, the Supreme Court declaring this week that sex discrimination laws apply to transgenders. The world is changing quickly and in irreparable ways. So I'm going to follow up with what I did on last Wednesday's show and try to give you some content that will brighten your day. Last week, we spoke to the directors and choreographers of the epic new Irish dance show Celtic Throne that is going to debut in Armstrong Auditorium in Edmond, Oklahoma on June 28th, just a week and a half from now. For today's show, I've invited a whole room full of the dancers from this show. They range in age from one who just graduated college all the way down to 4 or 5 years old. There are over 30 dancers in the show, and we're going to talk to 9 of them today. A really delightful conversation I'm certain you'll enjoy. That will be our second segment on the program today. After that, we're going to have a conversation about the importance of sleep. Very helpful topic, one that more and more people struggle with. If you haven't really studied into why you need to get enough sleep each night, you do need to look into this. We're going to talk with our health expert, Jörg Mardian, about what happens when you sleep and some strategies on how to improve your sleep. And then at the end of the program, my last word is about the importance of history that is very much under siege lately. But before we get into all of that, we're going to look at a very interesting situation developing in Syria. Bible prophecy forecasts a split between Syria and its ally and patron, Iran. But in spite of tremendous pressure, especially since the civil war began 9 years ago, these two countries have remained closely joined, and that now may be changing with the Trump administration in the United States imposing stringent new economic sanctions on Syria at a time when the regime is quite vulnerable. So we'll start the show by learning about this situation in this report from Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal.
For 9 years, the Syrian civil war has raged on. Over 700,000 people have been killed, and over 6 million others internally displaced from their homes. The lucky ones, another 5 million, have escaped the country. Some have walked to Europe, and the vast majority are now stuck inside Turkey. What's left of the rebel fighters have tried to overthrow the regime of Bashar al-Assad, are located inside the northwestern Idlib province, an enclave mixed with jihadis, freedom fighters, and another million civilians living under the protection of a Turkish security umbrella. The result of Assad's war is a human tragedy so unfathomable that it's barely considered by people outside the region. Yet, finally, change is coming to Syria. Today, the United States placed the most powerful financial sanctions yet upon the Syrian regime. Known as the Seize a Syrian Civilian Protection Act, the legislation empowers the United States to sanction any nation or individual that does business with the business sectors critical to the survival of the Assad regime. From today, anyone that does business with Syria outside of humanitarian support will be subject to the full force of the United States' secondary sanctions. Basically, what the United States has done to Iran, it's now forcing on Syria. The Caesar Act clearly labels Assad's regime as criminal, and anyone that does business with it will be punished. The decision by the Trump administration is the clearest sign yet from America that it seeks Assad's removal from office and is willing to do everything it can, short of military action, to accomplish that purpose. The sanctions will come at an extremely sensitive time for Assad, whose economy is already facing its worst downturn in history. The Syrian currency has lost half of its value in the past month. The hyperinflation has doubled the price of staples such as bread and sugar, and led the World Food Program to report last week that Syria is at risk of falling into mass famine. At least 85% of Syrians are already in poverty. Assad's traditional backers of Iran and Russia are too facing financial sanctions, making it virtually impossible for them to further support the regime. To keep afloat, Assad has started to demand massive tax payments from the private sector as well as lock up rich loyalists in order to take over their private businesses. Last week, Assad sacked his finance minister, likely to deflect blame for the economic situation. However, facing the surging food prices, many people are also taking to the streets with bold calls for Assad's removal from power. Earlier this week, Politico ran a story entitled, "Is Assad About to Fall?" in which Charles Lister describes how for the first time in 9 years, the notoriously submissive Druze community has started to protest. In protest last week, the Druze in the southern Sawadeh province said, "Cursed your soul, we are coming for you." Pro-Assad loyalists started violent counter-protests, but the Druze are yet to back down from calling for Assad's departure. The Druze uprising is indicative of Assad's heightened vulnerability, and as Lister relates, presents a new opportunity for the Trump administration to take down Assad. Lister wrote this, quote, "This new and almost unprecedented moment offers America an opportunity. Although it may seem like the Trump administration, and particularly the White House, has paid little attention to Syria, it has an opening now. If it uses its remaining levers to exploit Assad's new vulnerable position within an energized diplomatic effort, in concert with our many allies in Europe, the Middle East, and elsewhere, it has a chance to usher in real and long overdue changes to a country that could otherwise become a global tinderbox." End quote. No doubt some are wondering why it took almost a decade to enact the sanctions against the Assad regime. The Caesar Act itself is named after a Syrian defector who released about 50,000 images between 2012 and 2013 that provide proof of Assad's campaign of terror against his own people. Codenamed Caesar to disguise his identity, the former Syrian military police photographer took images of over 10,000 corpses that had gone through the notorious government-run Hospital 601. The Damascus Hospital was used in the processing of bodies and documenting deaths for the government of many of Assad's political opponents during the early years of the war. Caesar saved many of the images to thumb drives and hid them in his shoes as he smuggled the trove out of the country over a two-year period. The images were provided to U.S. law enforcement agencies in early 2014 and were made public in July of that year. The photographs provided, quote, "the best evidence to date of the industrial-scale campaign by the government of Bashar al-Assad against his political opponents," end quote, is what the Wall Street Journal said at the time. It was hoped by many, including Caesar, that the evidence would be used to create a strong case for Assad to be tried as a war criminal. However, such a case was never brought forward by the United States or anyone else. During 2014, the Obama administration was in the midst of negotiations with Iran, Assad's chief backer in the war, and knew that a decision to target Assad with prosecution would blow up the deal. Frederick Hoff, who served as a top Obama advisor for Syria, said that the evidence was, quote, "a double-edged sword for the administration." Hoff told the Wall Street Journal that, quote, "on the one hand, it's going to illustrate perhaps better than anything heretofore that absolute horror of what's going on. On the other side, it raises the inevitable question, what are we actually doing about it?" End quote. The Obama administration chose little to do with the evidence it got from Caesar. A similar decision was made in 2013 when Assad used mustard gas on his own people, killing 1,700 men, women, and children in a single attack. Even though that attack crossed President Obama's notorious red line, the United States failed to act against the regime. Frederick Hoff, again, told Jay Solomon in his book of the Iran Wars, quote, "there was definitely a fear that strikes in Syria could alienate the Iranians and make them walk away from diplomacy," end quote. And so, just as there was no retribution for the chemical weapons attack, Caesar's cache of evidence did nothing to motivate the Obama administration to act forcefully against Syria's Assad. As noted by Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry in his article Saving America from the Radical Left Temporarily, the election of President Trump has led to a prophesied temporary resurgence of the United States, both in America and abroad. Mr. Flurry wrote, quote, Donald Trump has proven himself willing to take a stand where others have not. It's quite something to behold him resisting these anti-American forces. When you compare what this president is doing to what his predecessor did, there has been a clear change in direction. We are now witnessing some of the knock-on effects internationally of the prophesied resurgence. When President Trump exited the deal in 2018, we noted that Iran would likely lose out in certain areas of power. Based on biblical prophecy, we indicated United States pressure could lead to Iran losing power inside Syria. We wrote this, quote, As we have forecast since the beginning of the Syrian civil war, Bible prophecy indicates that Iran will lose its position of influence inside Syria. United States pressure could lead to that change, end quote. With the Caesar Act striking Assad at his most vulnerable moment, it's likely that we will soon see Iran's ouster from Syria. Such a move would fulfill a landmark forecast made by Gerald Flurry 9 years ago, just after the Syrian civil war began. To study more of this biblical foundation to the forecast involving Iran's ouster from Syria, please read How the Syrian Crisis Will End.
Thank you very much for that, Brent. This, the timing of all of these events is really interesting. Donald Trump is coming to the end of his first term and possibly his only term in office. And you would think that, you know, he was talking a lot about wanting to put the screws on Iran from the beginning. Why do you suppose he waited so long? And it is interesting that that sanctions are his main weapon of choice for this.
Yeah, I think it is interesting looking at the what he campaigned on, pulling out of the Iran deal, talking about how horrible that was to empower America's greatest or Israel's greatest enemy in the Middle East. And yet it did take a while for the United States to enact sanctions again. I think it was towards the end of 2018 that they actually did that, almost 2 years into office. And here you have this coming down today. Something that is going to penalize Syria in a very powerful way. And we're almost, as you say, towards the end of his tenure in office, at least if he only goes one term. And I think a lot of that does go back to how the Obama administration, when they were pulling out, when they were creating the nuclear deal, there were several other programs by the FBI, the CIA, NSA, and other enforcement agencies that were shut down at the same time. It, just like we had Obama not strike out against Syria when the red line was crossed and he used chemical weapons on his country, on his own people, you know, Obama did not want to threaten the nuclear deal. And so he didn't act in that way because Syria is an Iranian ally. Mm-hmm. At the same time, he was shutting down a lot of investigations against, we've covered on this program before, the one against Hezbollah's drug ring that basically how Hezbollah was funded. He shut down he delayed this action as well. And in terms of Iran, there's a lot of people that the Treasury was not following up on in 2015 and 2016. And so it really did take a bit of time for Trump to get in there, the research again, to get to the point where they could start designating these individuals that were going to, or the movers and shakers in these in Iran's sphere of influence to actually affect the regime. What are you going to do? You're going to get in there in 2017, in February, and put sanctions on Iran. It's going to be very hard to make them effective because you've lost all the information that you would have had, let's say, 4 years ago that the Obama administration basically done away with. You also had the ousting of Flynn right at the beginning. He was President Trump's foreign policy man, one of the closest advisors to President Trump. And what did he know about? He knew about Iran. He knew about what Iran was doing in Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, and there he's gone. He's gone as you know, week two or three, and so you had a couple of these moves. One that the Obama administration did what it could to make it very difficult for sanctions to be reinstated on Iran.
and make it very difficult for sanctions to be snapped back. They and President Trump, I don't think, really could act effectively for a couple of years. Now, why does he choose sanctions over military action? I think that's pretty obvious, just because military action comes with a cost at the ballot box. Americans no longer, understandably in many ways, have the stomach for foreign interventions. And so he can't act in that way. And so he's limited then with sanctions. And if you're him, what there's no political pressure to not put sanctions on a country. And so if you can act to move, act in this way against Syria, just involving financial sanctions, and the United States is not going to be affected by lack of trade against the United States from Syria or elsewhere over this, then why not use that political tool that can be very effective when regimes are starving for money, as Assad is right now? And so it's a very effective way at minimal cost for Trump to affect change in the region.
We've been talking for years, based on Bible prophecy, about a divide taking place between Iran and Syria. We've been talking about it like as being an imminent type of a thing for quite a long time. This actually looks like it could put the nail in the coffin of this relationship.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we have said that Assad could be gone maybe four or five times since the civil war started back in 2012. And it really did look like he could be gone. Who would have suggested that Russia was going to come in 2015 back into the Middle East for the first time since the end of the Cold War? No one really predicted that. And yet Russia did, came and saved them for a bit. And so we've said it a lot, which is great, because when it does happen, then everyone that'll be a witness to the accuracy of biblical prophecy. We know, based on Psalm chapter 83, which details an end time alliance that has never taken place. This alliance didn't happen in parallel anciently. And so we know it's for the latter days. And it's a group of Middle Eastern nations that get together with Europe to actually confront and come up against Israel. And in that prophecy in Psalm 83, the Hagarenes are mentioned, and anciently they lived towards the western part of Syria. And so we know that Syria is going to be part of that alliance. And if you look at the other members of that alliance, you have Saudi Arabia, Emirates, Jordan, Turkey. You have everyone that's kind of not against Iran. And so it's this alliance of Psalm 83 that's aligned with Europe is actually an anti-Iranian alliance that has mainly ruled over by Sunni states. And so we can know, based on that Syria is not going to be fighting alongside Iran anymore. That is going to change. And not just Syria, but also Lebanon. And if you look at even the Caesar Act, what's interesting about it is it looks like it's going to target more than anything the way that Lebanon has been funding the Syrian regime to the tune of about $4 billion a year. It's quite a lot of money that Lebanon, broke as it is able to gut Hezbollah, is able to gut the services of Lebanon and send over about $4 billion worth of fuel into Syria to finance the Syrian regime. And those people, these smuggling routes that are coming from Lebanon, they're going to be shut down through these sanctions. And we know also that Lebanon isn't going to be part of the Iranian alliance either. They form part of this Psalm 83 alliance as well. And so this Caesar Act is really seen in some ways as a precursor to what the United States is about to do in Lebanon as well, at really coming down hard on Hezbollah further in Lebanon. And put together, it's really going to make things difficult for the Iranian regime to maintain power there.
Thank you very much. We've been talking to trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about the effects, the prophetically significant effects of these new sanctions on Syria. He's working on an article about this for thetrumpet.com. You can watch for that. It should be up on the website very soon if it's not there already. Thanks so much, Brent.
Thank you.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Celtic Throne is a new Irish dance production premiering in Armstrong Auditorium on June 28th, just a week and a half from now. It's getting extremely exciting. Last week, I spoke with the directors and choreographers on this program. Today, I've brought in eight of the dancers. Eight of the dancers, including one who has done some of the choreography. And I think this is a record number of guests on a Trumpet Hour. I've never had nine people in this studio all at once. We have Hannah and Zoe and Jude and Leah and Erica and Tara and Aaron and Noah and Ava. Hello, everyone. Good to have you here. Hello.
Hello.
All right. So we're getting down to just the last few days here. How are you guys feeling about how it's coming together at this point?
I feel like it's been very exciting the last couple weeks, but it's also getting fairly intense. I can definitely feel the pressure. I'm not a choreographer, but just as a dancer, the pressure is definitely getting heavier, but it's also just super exciting realizing that it's actually going to happen. So it's exciting.
So tell me about this. You've been hearing a lot lately about how you need to work harder than you have ever worked in your lives, right? I think I've heard, I've only been at some of the rehearsals and I've heard that probably three or four times in the last couple of weeks. Tell us what kind of work is involved in making a show of this caliber.
I think when they first said we needed to work harder than we ever have in our life, I kind of in my mind thought of physically dancing as hard as we could that we ever have. But when they said to run through it in our mind with the music and kind of envision ourselves doing the steps by ourselves, it made me realize that it's mentally too, that we need to work harder than we ever have in our life. And that's a whole nother aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's easy to only think about working hard in class, but there's also lots to do outside of class. I think lots of like strength workouts, flexibility, working out core, mm-hmm. and that type of stuff just to make your dancing as good as possible. There's not enough time in class to work on all of that, so
right.
we have to do a lot of work on our own time as well.
Yeah, now I was talking to Ava. You said, Ava, that you felt like the work that you're putting into Celtic Throne is actually helping you to learn how to work harder in other areas too. Tell us about that.
I do piano and like lots of other things, and at first I was still working hard, but it wasn't like the hardest I could. And then whenever we started doing this and they said to work a lot harder, then everything, I just started working like a lot harder.
That's great. So you actually feel like you're finding a new gear of hard work in your life because of this show. First of all, just to get an idea of how intense and detailed this is, I mean you guys are trying to achieve perfection in everything that you're doing here. I wanted to ask Jude to just give us a sample. Every now and then I'll hear you guys are explaining the step that you're going to be doing, and you'll be describing it to everyone, and you're going, you're saying it like it's like a foreign language. It goes so fast. I want to give a little bit of a sample of this.
Okay, I'm gonna have to turn on my British Irish dance teacher. Here.
That's right. Yeah. That was where I first heard it. It was in oh, yeah. the John Kerry documentary.
It's a lot bigger over there. He says all the steps when you're doing them. We right. don't do it as much here, but there's a step I could do. Something from our origins. Let's see. Drum, 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 stamp out and stamp, stamp, drum, 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 stamp, diddle, diddle, toe, stamp, back triple in toe, hop toe, back triple in toe, antip, down toe, back triple, hop back.
Nice.
You have to do it with your hands at the same time.
That's
otherwise
right.
You
yeah,
can't.
There's always the hand yeah, gestures.
There's always hand gestures.
Yeah, the simulating the feet. So you choreographed one of the numbers. Was it just one?
It was two.
Conflict.
Conflict and Resurgence. Resurgence isn't quite finished yet.
That's very interesting.
Well. So it was finished, and then our director had a really cool idea. Threw me a massive curveball. He's like, yeah, let's do it again this way. And
okay.
I was like, okay.
Okay, so but it'll be, conflict yeah. is really one of the big dramatic set pieces. Resurgence is a little, because it's not attached to a particular piece of music. Tell
it's
us
acapella,
about just
yeah.
the process that you went through in choreographing Conflict. How much was involved in that?
I never choreographed a group figure before. I've done a lot of hard shoe. I can choreograph solos pretty well. That's easier for me to do. Choreographing,
which makes sense because right. Conflict has what? How many people are on the stage?
20 people.
Yeah.
16 in soft shoe, 4 in hard shoe.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen a number quite like this one in another
the
show.
Combination.
It's very rare that you'll see a combination of hard shoe soloists with soft shoe dancers backing them up. So that was kind of a stab in the dark there. I thought it might work. I think it took quite a few tries. A lot of choreography is just trial and error. You give stuff to kids, it might look good, it might not, and then you change what looks bad and you keep what looks good.
Yeah.
So probably what you're seeing is a second, third, or fourth draft of what I originally came up with, which was absolute garbage.
You have this, this thing that you have doing where you have a central figure who's making movements, and then you have the entire rest of the people around him that are sort of reacting and amplifying what he's doing. That's just super cool. That took a lot of trial and error, I'm guessing.
Yeah, a lot of trial and error, and a lot of not necessarily going to the studio and trying things myself, but just thinking about, I'd have ideas during the day. What if I did this with his arm and then these mm-hmm. people react? It was kind of like never really, it was never really like totally out of the back burner. I don't know. It was never something that I wasn't really working on, if you know what I mean.
It was always on your mind on some level.
Obviously I would have to focus on other things, but it was always, I knew it was a project that needed to get done, and I just kind of chipped away at it. Probably took 3 or 4 months.
Yeah. So Hannah Worrell, she's one of these kids is doing her own thing. The only non-Irish dancer in the group, and you have a really unique role in this production. Maybe you can tell us about it.
Absolutely. It's definitely interesting. When I was first approached about it, I didn't know hardly anything about the show. I just knew I was in this one part, and it was a minute piece, so that's like eight counts. So I just knew I had to fill that space. And so it was really interesting for me, like, in this process, not really understanding the full show until I actually went to the first dress rehearsal, and I got to see how my piece fit in. So I'm pretty much just representing the emotional aspect. I feel like the style of dance I'm doing, which is lyrical, is very good at conveying emotion through your movements and your body, which, I mean, I don't know, I'm not an expert in Irish dance, but it's probably harder for that to be seen.
Right.
So, it was definitely interesting, and it's a difficult process to get emotion in your body, but that's basically what I'm doing is presenting emotion.
So. But you have a long background in ballet, and you're very accustomed to controlling your body as far as that goes, a classical ballet education. How much does that transfer over into what you're doing?
Yes, it's actually definitely helpful. When I first started dancing, when I was 12 or 13, I actually did start in lyrical, and that's how I got my start doing ballet. And then I did switch over to doing ballet until last year when I came to college, and I stopped for a year. But it's definitely helpful. I feel like it gave me a lot of just knowledge of my body and how I can use it. Using my core, my arms, everything. Like, there's never an unintentional moment, which is super helpful because it just helps me then when I'm doing the choreography and I have this idea to know what looks good on stage with my body versus what someone else could do. So it's really helpful to know how to control it and how to use it to, you know, the best you possibly can.
Yeah. Another aspect of this that I think is so cool, we have a pretty considerable dance program here, but we also have the other campus in Edstone where we've got dancers, and you guys all combined to put this together. But on top of that, we have a handful of dancers who are not in either of those locations, by yourself in the field working on Irish dance. This is one thing about the PCG. I think we've inspired a lot of young people to take up Irish dance. We have one dancer here, Erica, who is, you live in Washington State, but you're here for a few weeks in order to be able to contribute to this. What has this been like for you to be involved?
Yeah, it's been such a blessing. It's really great. I mean, ever since the auditions in December, you know, we were just anticipating, you know, when we would hear back and everything. And then in March, I think they were sending out the videos and, like, they announced that we were going to be in it, which was super exciting. And it's just amazing that we have the technology to do that. And it must have taken a while because all of the Edmund people and Edstone people, yes, they've been working on this for a while. And then they had to know the choreography before they can send it out to the out-of-towners. So that probably put a bit of pressure on them. But then, yeah, they sent it out, which is super nice. And then, you know, just giving detailed instructions, then we would have to record ourselves and send it back. And it was basically just, you know, like online school or something. And they would give us correction. And that was super helpful.
So they're sending you a video of what the steps are. So you're just following exactly what they have on the video. But then there's also formations, and you've got to be moving around the stage relative to a lot of other dancers. How did they teach that to you, and how much were you even able to do of that before you got here?
Yeah, so in the videos, yeah, sometimes you would see gaps for the out-of-towners, so I would try to follow along. I would watch the videos like 10 times and just try to figure out where I was. And yes, they did. It was nice because they had like a run-through of the entire dance with the music, and then they would kind of slow it down, and then some of the choreographers would, you know, just break it down slowly, which is super helpful.
So what did you think? You saw this for the first time when it was in a pretty advanced state. What do you think of it?
Yeah, it is amazing. I mean, it is incredible, like, just with the storyline and everything. But, yeah, I didn't know the exact order of everything. So just seeing that all and then just watching the reviews and just, yeah, the music is so powerful and just a blessing to be a part of.
So what do you guys think of the music for this show?
I think the music's really cool and how it can tie into all, like, the storyline and everything.
I really admire how Brian Byrne weaves the themes and his music.
What is your favorite part of the show?
For me personally, it's Gale in Conflict.
So what is it about? These are the two, like, dark ones.
Intense and dark and flashing lights.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It's just epic.
Yeah.
The music's really cool.
There is something about the music, though, that it adds a lot. You'd expect to come to an Irish dance show and hear, like, traditional Irish music. And it is. I mean, you have the Irish tunes, but it's very cinematic. Maybe listening to Heartbeat of Home, it's really not even like that. It's just imagine, like, a movie soundtrack with more Irish tunes kind of put on top of it. But then a lot of it's not really even Irish. We've got strings, like, Brian Byrne just did an incredible job, including the whole orchestra, obviously including the traditional Irish instruments, Gillian pipe, fiddle, and other things, flute and stuff. But it's really a whole orchestra combined with, like, a lot of synthetic sound effects and other things to make a really, really interesting sounding mix that I don't think our audience will have ever heard before.
What is it? None of you have ever been involved in anything on a scale of what you're working on now. Tell me about some of the lessons that you've learned from being a part of something where you really are being pushed to exceed anything you've ever done before. What are some lessons you've learned?
I've just been thinking a lot about all of the young people out in the field that may not have an opportunity such as this one, and it is such a huge opportunity, and I know Mr. McDonald has been encouraging us to make the most of it, and I know that all of us are striving to do the best we can, but I've just been thinking about all of those in the field and friends that I know of who maybe they're going through difficult things right now, or they can't go out and do things they normally would have. So I just have been trying to push myself as hard as I can for them and just really take the opportunity and run with it as far as I can go. So
yeah, I mean, it really is an amazing example to serve because, I mean, it is extremely hard and you have to put in the effort. And like Zoe said, you can't just do the practices. Like, you have to be doing it at home. And Mr. McDonald really encouraged us to, like, be listening to the music. And we really have to have this, like, throughout our minds, like, pretty much every day. And it is just really rewarding when people come up to us and just say how much hard work we've put in, even though, like, we may not feel like we're doing that good, but it just is encouraging. And then it helps us to practice and work harder.
Yeah, we watched the video the other night of last Friday's rehearsal, and you guys are all looking at all of the things that you need to improve on. I was just kind of sitting back and taking it in, and I was getting emotional every single song as I was watching it. I was just thinking, this is just spectacular. And then the lights would come up and it'd be like, yeah, we get it. The arms were wrong at this type of thing. Because you don't, you're not quite able to appreciate the inspirational quality of it when you're focused on the details. Yeah, Zoe.
I think for me, one major thing I've tried to do is just be patient. I think the teachers are doing their best to be patient with us. We mess up a lot, so I'm sure it's hard for them. But I also, I try to be patient with the teachers as well, because they've got so much on their plate. Mm. They're choreographing a lot of it, and then they're also dancing in it as well, and just trying to take care of so many details.
Whenever we first started doing it, I wasn't in a ton of stuff, and so then I told my mom about it, and she said that if I just worked harder, I might be able to be in more things. So I just started working like extra hard, and then they started putting me in a lot more things.
Very cool. So you work hard and good things happen. That's a good lesson for all of life. Being involved in something of this kind of a scale, there's going to be some times where God has to take over and help where we can't quite fill in. Have you guys seen some miracles or some things that have really inspired you being a part of this?
Well, it's just really cool how nobody has gotten very... largely hurt.
Nobody.
So. I also just think along those lines, God has protected us from illness, because throughout this whole time, I mean, we've had different things come up, but for the most part, everyone has stayed really healthy and strong. So along the same lines, but I think that's also a miracle.
And you guys have been working on that too.
Yes,
it's watching the diet, taking care of yourselves, getting enough sleep, all of those things too. Yeah.
I can just really tell that a lot of people are praying for us, and obviously we're praying that God would protect us from injury. But there was a woman that came up to me recently and was like, I've been praying for your joints and stuff. And I was like, oh, well, thank you. And honestly, I can tell. I mean, you know, the workload that I've had, it's different from, you know, training for Worlds or something, where it would be really intense for maybe 2.5 hours a day, 3 if you count workouts and stuff in addition to practices. This is more like, it's less intense, but it's pretty much all day, which
yep.
I would think is worse for your joints, because they don't get as much rest. But the soreness level has been very moderate for me, and I think for a lot of others as well, that we just haven't heard as many complaints about, you know, shin splints and other things as I was expecting. Mm. And I honestly think it is so many people are praying for our health and even our minds and everything, and we can really tell that. So we just want to thank everyone for praying for us, and then hopefully you can keep it up the next 2 weeks so that we can have a really good show.
Well, that is a wonderful note to end on. We've been talking with a whole crew of the dancers from Celtic Throne. June 28th is the premiere, 2 p.m. Central Daylight Time. Come to Armstrong Auditorium if you can. If you're within a drive of Edmond, Oklahoma, you can pick up tickets at armstrongauditorium.org. It will also be available to see online on July 5th. That is also, you can also find that on armstrongauditorium.org. Thank you all so much for coming in. That was fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Life can be very busy, and often when we get crunched for time, the first thing that suffers is our sleep. In the modern world, people are working longer, they're sleeping less than in previous generations. Technology, jet lag, job demands, sleep disorders, insomnia, shift work, all of these can make us sleepless. And sleep deprivation can have a lot of bad effects, mental, emotional, and physical. To talk about this, we have via Skype from his office in British Columbia, our go-to guy for all things health, personal trainer Jorg Mardian. Hello.
Hello there.
Tell us, Jorg, why is sleep so important?
Well, sleep is important because it represents a third of your life. That's about 24 years in bed.
It should be. It should be a third, right?
It should be, yes. But by definition, about 100 million Americans are chronically sleep deprived. And I imagine, you know, across North America, that's about the same. And, you know, looking into this subject, the more you study a subject, I mean, I've been in health for over 20 years, and you can't know everything about a subject, but it's really amazing what you don't know mm-hmm. and what you find out. So when we're actually sleeping, the brain is actually really active, you know, and it just performs this host of tasks. So just like the surface of the sea, the brain actually has waves, constantly moving waves, and they're called delta waves. They're just little tiny tremors in the cerebral cortex underneath the skull. So when you're in REM sleep, the rapid eye movement sleep, you have really swiftly changing brain waves. And non-REM sleep, it has slowly rising and falling waves. So basically, the deeper you sleep, the slower and larger the waves, and they really reflect the brain's idling restorative activity. It's hard at work making you healthy. So we need 7 or more hours of sleep a night. I mean, that's just universal advice from experts for most people, not everyone. And there was I was looking at a 2017 Chicago Tribune article, and it quoted sleep scientist Matthew Walker, and he's all over the news.
Yes.
And he says the number of people who can survive on 6 hours of sleep or less, and just anyone listening, just, you know, mark how much sleep you're getting mentally. He says if you're getting 6 hours of sleep or less and show no impairment, there's zero chance that you're not going to have impairment there. So 6 hours of sleep or less showing no impairment is actually zero. You're going to show a value of impairment. You know, there's a hard boundary on the lower end of sleep. And he says you can easily measure marked impairment in both the brain and the body. So if you're getting less than that 7 hours, there's going to be deteriorating health signs that we can see.
What kind of effects does sleep loss have?
Well, there's actually quite a few. So the most readily noticeable is you're not going to be alert. You're going to have decreased energy. You can feel that your mood swings are going to be up and down. Blood pressure raises. You're going to have inflammation throughout the body. And the way that you handle stress is decreased as well. So you're going to react to situations quite readily in a way that you don't like. Some things that people might not notice, especially for men, is that your testosterone levels at 6 hours of sleep or less a night is the same as someone 10 years older.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to fall. So if you're in your 50s, you're going to have the testosterone level of someone 60. Those same 6 hours also predict your risk for developing numerous forms of cancer. And scientists know that because there's a 70% reduction in cancer-fighting immune cells.
Hmm.
So, and now in regards to that blood pressure, there's also a corresponding 200% increased risk for a fatal heart attack or stroke in your lifetime. This is just lack of sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a increased development of a toxic protein in the brain called beta amyloid. And that's associated with Alzheimer's disease. So the scientists find that during sleep, the brain actually kicks into high gear and it starts to wash away this toxic protein. So the less sleep that you have, the more of this toxic protein you have and the higher your chance of Alzheimer's. So now, you know, people are going to say, well, I can catch up.
Mm-hmm.
I'll catch up on a weekend. It's possible, but the studies do show that it takes 4 days to recover from 1 hour of lost sleep.
Whoa.
That was my reaction. Now, imagine you miss multiple hours nightly.
Yeah.
You know, and it
so
just
essentially
makes it
chronic. Yeah, you're putting yourself into debt sleep-wise that gets worse and worse and worse. It's like racking up more and more debt on your credit card and it never quite goes away.
Right. You won't pay it off And then there's also what's called microsleep, and this is the really hard one that people don't really realize, where sleep just intrudes into wakefulness for brief episodes.
Yeah.
And so that can be dangerous, because when we're driving or operating machinery such as trains or planes, and that happens a lot more than people realize. The studies show that tired people can have 79 to 80 microsleep episodes per hour when they're tired.
Right.
And these last between 1.1 and 6.3 seconds.
Yeah.
So, and more than 20 studies show with driving simulators that's equivalent to being legally drunk.
Yeah.
When you're behind the wheel. And I mean, that reflects in the statistics, because a third of tired drivers actually fall fully asleep at the wheel and go off the road. And there's about a million crashes a year that they attribute directly to that problem. When you make it to work, or if you make it to work safely, it will have a measured effect on your performance. You know, just a couple of nights of insufficient sleep. And if anybody has employees, they have all these markers, because they look at how people perform. There's a 4.8% decline in performance, just a couple of nights of insufficient sleep. So it's almost as though without sleep, the memory and functioning inbox of the brain seems to shut down, and you end up feeling as though you're an amnesiac.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and some people try to counteract the sleepiness and they take caffeine or energy drinks. And then at night they may take sedatives as a fix. But basically those are just band-aids to a problem that you should be fixing correctly. And those sleeping pills are highly addictive. And again, there's a cancer risk with those as well. So all of this, you know, all of this becomes a vicious cycle that you go through with your health and your performance. So you have this substellar job performance and health issues. And basically that contributes to almost 1.25 million annual loss working days.
Mm-hmm.
And the price tag's pretty hefty too. It's over $400 billion. So it's not a small problem at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I looked into this subject pretty intensively several years ago and really made some major corrections to my own sleep habits. And I know at that time, I was actually reading the Gulag Archipelago of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and he has a whole chapter there about the kind of torture techniques that the Russian officials would use on the people that would come in. Sleep deprivation was number one. Absolutely, the first thing that they would do is deprive the person of sleep, make them stay awake for a long, long time, and it would make them a lot more susceptible to all of their other tactics that they would use. And I thought, why would I do this to myself? So let's talk about the things that you can do that really improve your sleep, even for the person who says, yes, I want more sleep, where there are people who go to bed but they just can't get to sleep, or they wake up in the middle of the night and have a lot of troubles. What sort of advice can you give them?
Right. Well, some people really do have health problems. You can have, but that's a small subset of people. Most of us have habits, and we're used to those habits, and we say we don't have time. Well, we have to create time. But one of the most healthy things you can do for yourself to help yourself unwind is to get some natural sunlight throughout the day. And I think we talked about sunlight before, mm-hmm. and its effects on health in general. You know, so in the presence of light, the melatonin, that's the sleep hormone levels, they fall and we stay alert. So you want that during the day. And most of us don't get a lot of sun anymore because we're in offices. And now the opposite applies. When it gets dark, we get drowsy. So, but what that also means at night is that we have to do something. And one of those main things is to limit technology. Because, the laptops and the televisions and the cell phones, even overhead lights, they emit blue light that reduces melatonin and keeps us awake. So a good nightly habit is to create a bedtime window of about an hour to wind down. Mm-hmm. And most people don't do that. So you want to get a habit going, change in your pajamas, enjoy some family time, have a cup of tea or listen to calming music, read a book. Just get into that habit every night. I would also say to people, when you wake up, so plan when to wake up. So if you're getting up at 7, count backwards from that time for the amount of sleep that you need. Now, again, that's not the same for everybody. I might wake up with 7 hours in sleep and feel fantastic. I might not be able to sleep more. Okay, so genetically, not everybody's the same. Some people need 10 hours or they're just bears the next day. So you want to count the hours backwards that you need, knowing how much sleep is good for you, and then set a reminder alarm at night to hit the sack at an appropriate time. Mm-hmm. And that's a key habit many sleep experts recommend. And while habits don't necessarily make you sleepy, it's the steady routine that primes the body to relax and sleep soundly. So the body reacts very nicely to routine. Once you're in that routine, it might not work immediately.
Yeah.
But when you're a month into it, your body's actually primed for that. And if you reduce the factors, say a lot of this artificial lighting that's in our modern technology, that's most of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah, it's funny when you go camping and you're just out in the middle of the woods, the sun sets and you're kind of like, yeah, feeling pretty much ready for bed.
Of course, that's how it was in times of old. I mean, who wants to stay up with candlelight? You know, you're going to fall asleep. The sun goes down, you know it's time. That was the time to go to sleep. Sun comes up, you get up. That's how it was for thousands of years. Now, with modern technology, all of a sudden we had this lighting. And then so we start intruding. We start blurring the borders between day and night.
Yeah.
And we start pushing those. And so our social life extends. And all those things that we count as fun, but they're actually extremely detrimental to us. We have something that we need to take care of, and that's our health. And sleep, you can look at sleep as just something, well, we do it, we need it, we get tired. But if you really understand it, if you get a sufficient sleep, you're taking care of your body. It builds character through discipline. And I love that because it tells me that if I have the discipline to go to sleep and I don't take it for granted, I'm actually building up my health.
Yeah.
And the upside is then I'm going to emerge from that fog of sleeplessness and I'm going to have peak performance day after day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a fantastic point. The fact is that if you prioritize it and you make it a habit to do these things every night, you just say it's very important that I get that sleep, you're going to make that happen. If you don't make it a priority, if you take it lightly, then all kinds of things will intrude and you're going to be suffering the consequences, and sometimes without even really realizing how good you could feel if you improved those things.
Well, that's correct. And I think I've, you know, during a previous show, I've told you during my life, I've pushed myself many, many years. I'm just, you know, a worker. I love to work. And oftentimes in my youth, I overdid it.
Yeah.
Long, long, long hours, and you're barely getting enough sleep, and you're dragging your rear end into the next day. And it just gets monotonous. But I didn't really understand the effects of that. I just thought, well, I'm tired. That's not good enough. You really have to understand why you're tired and what the body does when you get sufficient sleep, and that's enough. It's the same as something for food, for reading a label. If you read the label, you understand that food might not be good for you.
Yeah.
It gives you information, then you can act on that, and you act on it, and you improve your health.
Well, thanks very much. We've been talking to Jörg Mardian about the problems of sleep deprivation and the benefits of good sleep habits. He's working on an article about this that you can watch for at thetrumpet.com. Jörg, thanks as always.
It's been my pleasure.
It's time for today's last word.
The value of history is understood less and less in our world. It's an easy subject to underestimate, but the reality that is becoming clearer and clearer to me personally, the more I study it, is that knowing history is vital to a people's survival. Last summer, I took my family to our campus in Edstone, England, to participate in our youth summer camp there. And during the camp, the whole group took a bus into London. And we had two main stops on our trip, the British Museum and the Churchill War Rooms. Both of these places were rich in crucial history, and I was really thrilled that we were able to create an experience like that to help these young people forge stronger connections with the past. At the British Museum, we saw several artifacts that spanned millennia, proving the veracity of the history contained in the Bible. These teenagers, they could see the savage brutality of the Assyrian people displayed on the Lachish reliefs. These are preserved from over 2,700 years ago. They could see the Taylor Prism with its account by King Sennacherib of besieging Jerusalem. And that full story is told in the biblical books of Chronicles and Isaiah. They could see the Cyrus Cylinder. This is 2,500 years old, bringing to life the history of Cyrus, this Persian king who set captive Jews free in order to rebuild Jerusalem. These are just a few of the many displays showing all this history, the wealth, the inventiveness, the precision, the craftsmanship, the social life, the paganism, the humanness of these bygone generations from all over the world. Every nook and cranny in this museum had curiosities and mysteries and lessons from the past. The Churchill War Rooms, these are the bunkers that are tucked under Whitehall Street that served as Britain's command center during World War II, and they've been converted since then into an outstanding museum. It made the history of Britain's finest hour wonderfully vivid. We got a sense of the destructiveness of the German Blitz and the solidarity of the Londoners cheerfully accepting the privation and the rallying to a mountain opposition, the night and day labor of Prime Minister Winston Churchill and his staff, and the determination and the indomitability required to vanquish the Nazis. This was all extremely valuable and very relevant history to ponder. It just happened that on the ride into the city, as we were taking this field trip, I started to read Gerald Fleury's booklet, The Book of Chronicles, and he made this statement on the very first page. This world is lost in the present. God is always challenging his people to keep the overview, to see the grand sweep, both historically and prophetically. It's so important that we have that overview. Creating connections with the past orients us, and it stabilizes us. It gives us specific lessons that can help us in our decision-making, both individually and nationally. It supplies our memory as a people, as well as our understanding of and our appreciation for personal and national character. It helps us and fortifies us to face hardships with resolution. It gives us a realistic sense of just how cruel human nature can be, the magnitude of the effort that is needed in order to conquer human nature. And it's also extremely prophetic, since history tends to play out in repetitive cycles. The lessons are many, and they are invaluable. Yet in our world today, history is being erased, rewritten, neglected, forgotten. In our universities, fewer and fewer undergraduates are taking history classes. Fewer colleges are insisting or mandating that they do. Fewer students are graduating with history degrees. History instructors are moving away from classic history and toward more specialized and suspect classes, like Harvard has a class on emotions in history, Yale in indigenous religious history, Stanford has a class called Mad Women, the history of women and mental illness in the U.S. What sort of lessons will that history teach? Is that the kind of history that will fill our students with a sense of positive purpose? Will it inspire them to follow the best examples of their forebears, to build heroic character? Will it strengthen them for future challenges? The better you understand history, the better you can understand why our ignorance of it is so dangerous And the more you can see why we cannot afford to get lost in the present. We must accept God's challenge to keep the overview, to see the grand sweep, both historically and prophetically. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Brent Noctegal, Jorg Mardian, and all of our Celtic Throne dancers. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Charles Maurice. I am more afraid of an army of 100 sheep led by a lion than an army of 100 lions led by a sheep. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.